From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. My name is Noel. Sitting here to my left is Matt, the invisible Matt.
He's imaginary for this episode.
Our imaginary friend.
Yep. And they call me Ben. We're joined with our long-suffering super producer, Paul Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, and that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. Noel, did you ever have an imaginary friend growing up? Serious question.
Yeah, no, I've thought about that, and I've ultimately decided that I did not, and it made me sad. But is it more sad to have one or to not have one? You tell me.
Yeah, it's a question that I think depends on people's perspective. Earlier, before we went on the air, we were asking Paul whether he had an imaginary friend, and he told us that by the time he, growing up, realized what that concept was, maybe he had already sort of missed the window and realized that, you know, there was a difference between what is real and what is imagined. And did you know anybody who said they had an imaginary friend? I knew some people when I was, you know, my younger days, who said that they knew just someone. And sometimes it was uncreative. I grew up in preschool. There was a kid who had an imaginary friend. You know what his name was?
Mm-mm.
Ethan.
Ethan.
That's just not very, you know, what happened to, like, Admiral Squackentops?
Yeah. What was the one from Inside Out?
I don't remember. I think mainly of Drop Dead Fred.
Oh, that was a good one. No, the one from Inside Out was Bing Bong. And he's like a magical elephant, and it is one of the most heart-wrenching sequences in any film, animated or otherwise, and I will stand by that to my dying breath when Bing Bong – something happens to Bing Bong. Let's just put it that way.
Oh, no.
It has to do with growing up.
Oh, gosh, yes. And some of this episode touches upon the very same rites of passage, we could call them, right? Today, friends and neighbors, imaginary friends, those non-corporeal, non-physical associates, confidants, family members loved by children across the world and throughout the ages, more often than not, they're regarded as a phase of sorts, right?
Yeah, it's true. So today we're here to work out exactly what it means when we say imaginary friend. Matt, what do you think? All right, Matt says that according to developmental psychologist Tracy Gleason, it is tough to predict or even measure, quantify what a child will actually say when asked this question, what is your imaginary friend? We've said, do you have an imaginary companion? And they respond, that sounds awesome. So they go, yes, yes, of course I do. That's like me. I wish I did.
Sure.
I don't think I did, but I would like to have had that.
And they begin to improvise.
Maybe I wasn't creative enough as a child.
Oh, don't beat yourself up. But it's a great point. They will begin to confirm what they want to have true. Yes, I do have a friend. His name is Ethan. He wears a red jumpsuit, you know? And then it's easy once you have that basis to explore and create details. So for psychologists, it's difficult to know whether a child is improvising this, as we said, or whether they're describing, you know, someone as real as Matt standing here, right? Totally.
He's nodding.
He's nodding. And you make a great point, Matt. Psychologists divvy up the broad category of imaginary friends into two groups. They're completely invisible pals, and then they're personified objects. And this is where we see stuff like a favorite stuffed animal or the horror trope of the haunted doll.
Well, and sometimes don't those things merge? Couldn't you have an imaginary friend that embodies said favorite stuffed toy?
Mm-hmm, totally, right? Like Ethan used to not have a home, but now he lives inside this VHS cassette.
I had this thing. His name was Teddy Ruxpin, and I swear to you, he talked.
I'm familiar with Teddy Ruxpin. Did you ever put a heavy metal album or some underground hip hop into his cassette player?
Cassette player? What are you talking
oh,
about?
Oh, right. Well, I guess mine came with a cassette player, but I don't want to ruin this for you.
Teddy was my pal.
he probably still is. You know, maybe you can reach out to him though.
Actually, okay, I'm joking. But did you hear that the new Teddy Ruxpin is like internet connected and can like pull phrases and stuff off the web? It's almost like an Alexa in toy form.
Oh, that's spooky.
Not cool.
No, not cool. Stop normalizing constant surveillance, right? According to Dr. Cheryl Gonzalez-Ziegler, an imaginary friend is a made-up or unreal companion that typically provides comfort or support to a child. When it's an invisible friend, they'll say something along the lines of, Annie is my pal, she goes everywhere with me, and you can't see her, but I can see her. And then there are also these imaginary friends that are these personified objects. So, to Noel's example, like a Teddy Ruxpin. And according to Dr. Ziegler, the relationship there is more of a caretaking thing. Like, I am taking my stuffed animal with me because they only like particular things and only I know how to make these sandwiches for them or put them to bed.
Yeah, it's like a way of developing qualities of nurturing maybe, you know?
That's a really good point, yeah. And when Ziegler says these can be imaginary friends, it's exactly the way that you just described it, Noel. They're assigning these animate qualities to an object, right?
And I'm no psychologist, but it occurs to me that, you know, young girls, and I'm, you know, my daughter is a young girl, maybe focus a little more on that nurturing lesson, and the boys maybe are a little more light at learning how to be more rough and tumble and, like, you know, fighting and stuff.
And we have to wonder how much of that is society, you know?
Sure it's like all society. Right. It's just an observation, totally, totally off the cuff.
Because remember, you know, I'd be very interested in the history of toys to find who made the decision to call something an action figure if it's for a boy and a doll if it's for a girl. You know, that's maybe a story for a different show or a little bit of an Edward Bernays show.
Mm-hmm.
So these objects aren't, of course, limited to things like dolls or stuffed animals. There's an expert who says she once heard about a child who formed, get this, a close relationship with a can of tomato paste.
I can see that.
Inseparable bond.
It's a very appealing looking can. I mean, you're talking about the smaller ones?
They do not go into
detail. The paste
usually
come in smaller cans. Yeah. You know, that's what I would want to be friends with. The regular sized ones just seem too aggressive.
So the smaller one's a little more endearing,
yeah,
you think?
Yeah, to me. Yeah, it's cute.
And although there is some levity in this, it's also true that imaginary friends are more common than we might wait for it. Imagine.
Mm.
I know, it's a rough one.
Go on.
Well, approximately 30% of American children between the ages of 3 and 6 develop some sort of imaginary companion. And that's just counting the ones that are invisible friends, totally non-corporeal entities that aren't tied to, you know, a Ruxpin or a boot. I don't know why that's the only other example I had.
Hmm. A boot?
Yeah.
Like the way Canadians say about?
Oh, no, like a shoe.
Oh, I see.
Yes. There are other studies too, Noel, and they argue that more broad investigation reveals over 50% of children have had some sort of imaginary friend in their childhood. And that's a little difficult for me because you and Paul and Matt and I don't, you know, we can maybe recall wanting to have an imaginary friend, but unless something traumatic happened and we've blocked it out, it doesn't seem like any of us made the leap. So I wonder how they're defining it there. And often, it's important to note, often these imaginary friends are not crucial to a child's social sphere. You know, Professor Lizard is cool, right? But Professor Lizard isn't around all the time.
Professor Lizard is cold-blooded.
That's true. Literally true. But the child will have other real-life friends. And, you know, in Hollywood, because we talk about pop culture and how it applies to stuff on this show, right? In Hollywood, imaginary friends are often portrayed as a sign of a personality disorder or a horror trope or even mental illness.
Yeah, like in Beautiful Mind. Can I spoil A Beautiful Mind?
Yeah, go for it.
He has an imaginary friend that you think is real. And then, spoiler alert, turns out it's all in his beautiful mind.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen it.
It's the one about, oh, sorry.
No, don't apologize. I'll still watch it. I love spoilers.
I think we've passed the statute of limitations. It's at least 5 years old.
I believe you're right.
No, it's about a brilliant mathematician who struggles with mental illness, and it is personified in this character who you meet and then find out, you know, with the twist that he's not real. Or like a Fight Club kind of situation.
Sure.
Kind of spoil Fight Club for everybody.
I think that's well past the statute.
Just saying, the whole multiple personality thing, and it has become kind of a toxic trope in that it's a little bit cliched and lazy writing in a lot of ways, you know, and in a way without actually exploring someone's struggle in a character-driven way. It's more mm-hmm. in like this kind of – this Shyamalanian twist that's sort of been done to death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Look what I can plot, right? We spent so long wondering whether we could make a plot twist that we never asked ourselves whether we should. And thankfully in real life, this is not the case. Imaginary friends, experts find, are potentially beneficial to a kid's mental health. According to family therapists, imaginary friends are often found amongst children who are well-adjusted socially, even prone to smiling and laughing slightly more than their peers, which I know could sound kind of sinister because now we all have the picture of, you know, little Lisa or little Bart just sitting by themselves in a classroom and occasionally going.
Well, what's the difference between having an imaginary friend and just having an imagination?
That's true, right? Is it a symptom there? Because we know that this occurs with children most often, right? Just like your example from Inside Out, at some point, children typically grow out of and away from the imaginary child phase. And around the age of 7, the imaginary friend either goes away, might stick around a little bit longer, but in some cases, these invisible friends or, again, objects imbued with personality follow someone into adulthood.
I'm sorry, Matt, what? Yeah, totally.
And we'll be back after a word from our sponsor. So the earlier question, what's the difference between an imaginary friend and just having an imagination?
Or just imbuing your playthings with personality, you know? Like I definitely played with action figures, there we go again, and dolls, whatever, what have you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would have them talk to each other. I would pretend to that what I was doing was in some way, you know, had a real outcome or whatever. How's that, you know, is an imaginary friend specifically one? Can you have a stable of them? Like, I don't know.
Sure. Yeah. And then, you know, lest we be too quick to judge people, we have to ask ourselves who among us has imbued some sort of personality into a common everyday object. People name their cars, right?
I used to do it with spoons.
You used to do it with spoons. Mm-hmm. No kidding. Mm-hmm. What could you tell me about one?
It was Ethan.
It was Ethan, Ethan the spoon in its red jumper. Yes. So we often ask ourselves whether an imaginary friend is a form of hallucination, right? But as it turns out, this isn't the case, experts argue. Instead, the perceived being is a vivid fantasy, and it helps the child address emotional concerns or pursue play, practice empathy, and most importantly, model later social behaviors. And we have a quote about this from Ellen Giralda.
That's right. She is a professor of child and adolescent psychiatry at Imperial College London. And she says they do not have the actual perceptual experience of seeing and hearing. Another key difference, she says, is that, quote, hallucinations feel imposed and children cannot exercise a direct control over them. This came from The Guardian.
Okay, so in that case, it means that if we had an imaginary friend who, you know, Professor Lizard, right? You could interact with Professor Lizard, but you could also escape Professor Lizard if you wanted to. Shut it off.
Yeah, it's like a switch. And, you know, people that suffer from genuine hallucinations, there is no escape. Mm-hmm. And they require medication to make them go away, you know, sedation or other psychoactive drugs that have to be prescribed to deal with these hallucinations, which can be symptoms of serious mental illness.
Yeah, absolutely. And the strange thing is that hallucinations do appear to be, let's say, not common but less uncommon than one might think. Recent studies have pointed out some surprising statistics about how common hallucinations can be. One study in the United Kingdom found that almost two-thirds of children reported having at least one, quote, psychotic-like experience in their lives. And that's a category that also includes unshiftable, unrealistic beliefs and fears. You know, I can't go into the closet ever. I can't go under the bed, or the blender is evil.
Yeah.
I made up that last one, but I'm sure it happened to someone.
So when you focus purely on hallucinations, a review of the research out there found that 17% of 9 to 12-year-olds have these experiences at any given time. The number roughly gets cut in half with teenagers and then drops again in adults.
And it's interesting because 9 to 12 is maybe a little bit older in terms of what we would expect to encounter regarding an imaginary friend. So again, we see that hallucinations are different. And the research on this is very tricky, not quite as tricky as a Shyamalan plot twist, but still tricky all the same. Since this research tends to focus on experiences that are selected because they can appear in mental health problems in adults, such as, for instance, hearing voices, right, which has been the subject of a lot of investigation in the past, right?
Yeah, well, like witch hunts even. I mean, like, sure, you know, it being a sign of possession or something like that. You know, very outdated notions of some sort of demonic malevolent force at work.
Right, right. Or a divine supernatural force such as Joan of Arc claiming to hear voices.
Yeah, it ultimately resulted in the same outcome though, didn't it?
It's true. It's true.
I just mean that she was, you know, vilified for having this because she claimed to know things that only a high priest should know, like someone very high up in the religious order.
Right, especially when this it was in a religion that required intercession, right, and wherein somebody could not speak directly to a god.
Needed a liaison in the form of someone who was learned and had the proper pedigree for that communication, which I still just find funny.
But your point remains there. When we're looking at this research, we have to remember that these things that could also be pinged as mental health issues are only a small part of the possible range of hallucinations, which means the figures that Noel quoted earlier are likely to be a lower conservative estimate. And it's true that in rare cases, medical problems could be the cause. Epilepsy can cause hallucinations. What's the longest time you've ever stayed awake that you remember?
Oh, no, I'm a sleeper. I mean, I stayed up all night once when I was a kid. I'm kidding. No later than, 5 in the morning, and then I slept most of the day probably.
Mm-hmm. I have experimented in the past pushing myself to see how long I can stay awake. And at a certain point, reality gets fuzzy. The edges blur.
I would like to encounter you in one of these experimental places.
I hear I'm a lot of fun.
I bet.
but I don't remember quite a bit of it. Luckily, though, severe psychoses or other medical conditions represented perhaps by diagnoses such as schizophrenia, luckily, they're extremely rare in young children. People aren't completely sure why this happens, but it's winning a brutal and terrible lottery for a young child to exhibit those sorts of conditions. But of course, when they occur, they can be striking and terrifying. And this leads us to a question for today's episode, an interesting twist. Because you see, some people believe, friends and neighbors, that there is more to the story. What if imaginary friends and other non-corporeal, non-physical perceived entities are not just make-believe models for addressing emotions and social behavior? What if they're not hallucinations brought about by stress or some sort of medical condition? What if these largely non-physical beings are real?
Yeah, I don't know, Ben. You want to get crazy?
Here's where it gets crazy. Research on the subject is surprisingly sparse, but it's safe to say that for many children or even adults experiencing this phenomenon, imaginary friends are to some degree real. And the people who believe there's more to the story will typically argue something along these lines. One of the first would be allegations of psychic powers. This is one of those very popular tropes in fiction, and you might be familiar with it from stories like The Shining. You know, let's go ahead and spoil The Shining. Remember when the little Torrance kid is always going, "Red rum."
That's not really a spoiler, is it?
I hope not.
Everybody knows that.
You know, somebody might. If that's a spoiler for The Shining, then they probably don't know what The Shining is to begin with.
Yeah, that is his imaginary friend. It's Tony. And in the book, I don't think it comes up in the movie, but he says he lives inside his mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And in the movie, he uses his finger to represent him talking.
And in the book, someone correct me on this. In the book, I believe it's implied that the imaginary friend is actually Danny Torrance from the future or something talking to himself. I'm not clear. It's been years since I read it. But that's an example of a supposedly imaginary friend being a real, independent, separate entity despite the fact that he lives in his mouth. I'm glad you pointed that out. And then, of course, there's the excellent, the superb Cyndi Lauper, Jeff Goldblum vehicle from the late 80s, I want to say, Vibes.
I do not know Vibes, Ben.
Vibes. Vibes is a terrible film. Okay, so just to set the stage, there is this group of people with some sort of differing specialization as far as psychic powers go. Jeff Goldblum plays one of the main characters who has psychometry, which means he touches things and he's able to know stuff about them. And yes, before you ask, he is just being Jeff Goldblum. So it's, you know.
Well, that's kind of all Jeff Goldblum ever does.
Right, right. I just want to say he's not, you know, yeah. He's not doing a German accent or anything.
I've yet to see Jeff Goldblum play anything outside of just a Jeff Goldblum type character. But what happens in Vibes? What are we talking about here? How does the psychic powers enter into this imaginary friend phenomenon?
Cyndi Lauper, the romantic interest and the co-lead, has the ability to know things she would not normally know, stuff from the future, stuff that's happening far away, because she has an imaginary friend. And in this story, her imaginary friend that she kind of grew up with, or I think it happened after an accident, is actually a ghost, right? And that's something we see so often in fiction, the idea that someone with an imaginary friend is in fact mistaking their relationship. They're not speaking with a figment of their own Jungian archetypes or subconscious. They're communicating with an otherworldly form.
Yeah. Like the little Forrest Gump kid that sees dead people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not going to spoil that one.
Oh,
that's where I draw the line.
That's all that film has. Yeah, you'll also find, interestingly enough, outside the realm of fiction, you'll find a wealth of anecdotes arguing this point of view. People claiming that their kid from a very young age spoke to a deceased relative or displayed knowledge of some event or skill or language it was impossible for them to know. So what would some examples of these types of anecdotes be?
You mean in terms of like malevolent forces at work?
Sure. Just something, you know, creepy, right? For people who believe that they or their child has been in contact with some sort of entity.
Yeah, actually, we found a list of some encounters, I guess you could say, of this variety. Can't confirm that these are real or not, but some of them really ring true and have a very sinister vibe to them. And here's one that's titled, "Evil is Coming." When my older daughter was 2 or 3, she used to have a couple of imaginary friends, Dodo and Dee Dee. They were typical imaginary friends. She would talk to them and play with them and tell me about their lives. Then one day, she was about 3, she was talking on her play phone when I walked into the room. She, quote, hung up her phone and said to me with a completely flat voice and deadpan expression, "The evil is coming." I want to know more.
That sounds like a setup for a story, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing is that in most cases, you can't really verify these reports. They're what do you call it? Creepypasta?
A little creepypastas almost, yeah.
Yeah, because there's not a clear attribution. They have the tone of campfire stories. In some cases, these were found to be – the ones that were actually investigated were found to be mistakes of an entirely understandable sort. You know, the kid heard something on television and repeated it, right?
Isn't the whole thing about creepypasta, too, the pasta comes from the fact that it's paste, it's like cut and pasted from somewhere.
Copy-paste,
so it implies that it was like, it existed in a real form, or like it was from a blog or some like actual encounter, but you can't really tell.
Right, yeah. It's like many urban legends, it's always a friend of a friend I met passed through a town where there's a story that's real about a killer. And sometimes those stories do turn out to have a grain of truth that sort of made a pearl of wisdom in the oyster of legend. Boy, walked a long way for that comparison. But in many other cases, they're also found just to be hoaxes, trolling attempts, maybe just an endeavor to disguise fiction as fact for an added scare factor. But this leads us to another strange twist in the story, and we'll get to it after a word from our sponsor. There's another aspect here that developed, or we should say encountered, a renaissance of sorts in the digital age, and that's the idea that some imaginary friends might be what's called a tulpa.
Yeah, I only just discovered that recently in watching the new Twin Peaks, The Return. It comes up a lot, and it's really almost impossible to spoil the new Twin Peaks. There's one spoiler I could give for the original Twin Peaks, which I will not do. But the new one is so dreamy and strange, and there are like, you know, created entities that are kind of referred to as tulpa, but they never actually call them that in the show. But in people writing about it and Lynch talking about it, that's what they are. They're sort of these like almost facsimiles of people that take their place in reality, and then but they're not actually them, and they're in some way malevolent and meant to do harm, at least in the world of Twin Peaks. But that is the first time I ever encountered that term. But let's talk more about what it means in traditionally.
For sure, yeah. The term tulpa comes from a later Western adaptation of a much older concept of the mind-made body or emanation body, also known as the tulku, the sprulpa, or the nirmita, and others. And these are found in Indian and Tibetan Buddhism. Theosophists, the Westerners who adapted and some would say appropriated this idea, were calling these things thought forms as early as 1927. And the essential gist is this, that if you meditate, if you concretely visualize a entity, if you spend enough mental energy imagining and picturing this thing, then it can become real and acquire an increasing degree of sentience and agency. There's a Belgian-French explorer named Alexandre David Neal who said that once the tulpa is endowed with enough vitality to be capable of playing the part of a real being, it tends to free itself from its maker's control. And this, say Tibetan occultists, happens nearly mechanically, just as a child, when their body is completed and able to live apart from the mother, leaves the womb.
Well, Ben, I completely glossed over the fact that you too have seen Twin Peaks: The Return. What did you think about the way this concept plays into it? This idea of a manufactured, I don't know, facsimile of a person that exists in some other form.
My favorite part about the newest Twin Peaks series was reading the reviewers' increasingly surreal attempts to explain to themselves what was going on. Mm-hmm. And you have to, because there are times where there's gorgeous cinematography, there's an obvious mythology and cosmology at play here, but it has the logic of a dream. Mm-hmm. You know, like why are these facsimiles, and I appreciate that word, these doppelgangers, for lack of a better term, why are these inherently malevolent, right? Why are they here just to mess stuff up? Do they want to supplant the actual people, right? That's a common theme we see. But I do want to point out one of the things I found the most interesting is that, Noel, you're correct. I don't believe in the story anybody actually calls anyone else a tulpa.
No, they don't. But like I said, in reading about it and even in hearing, I think Lynch himself used that word. But especially referencing the character of Diane, who in the first season, the first two seasons of Twin Peaks, you only ever experienced in the form of Agent Dale Cooper talking to his tape recorder.
Yeah.
And in The Return, we get to meet Diane, who is played beautifully by Laura Dern. But – and this is a little bit of spoilers for Twin Peaks The Return. So I'm going to give you 5 seconds. Is that cool? We got 5 years.
That works.
5 seconds is a warning.
Sure.
The character that you actually meet is a tulpa, is a facsimile of the real Diane. And you – again, some of it's pretty hard to wrap your head around. You – she does – she kind of disappears and then like there's a version of reality where Dale Cooper – is with the real Diane, and then they end up going back in time or something, and they end up having a tryst in a hotel room, but then they walk out and they're in another version of reality, and that's the real Diane.
Mm-hmm.
I think the tulpa Diane, when she whips out that gun, and then she ultimately kind of turns into smoke and a little gold ball.
Yeah.
Is this ringing a bell?
Yeah. This is – it's very strange a strange interaction, especially when we consider the symbolism of it. And the idea still remains the same, that a tulpa can be generated by concentrated thought, right? So for Alexandra David Neal, this explorer believed that she had created a tulpa in – get this though – in the image of a Friar Tuck-like monk, which later developed a life – all its own, and despite its raucous Dionysian nature, it had to be destroyed. And in her defense, Alexandra David Neal does say that this may have all been a hallucination. Yet she adds, other people saw this Friar Tuck tulpa too. Strange, no? Perhaps it's just a branch of spirituality that will be relegated to history along with other, you know, somewhat pseudo-mystical movements of the time.
Sure.
You know, but if we fast forward to the modern day, we'll see that the concept of tulpas is mentioned in, as we said earlier, Twin Peaks. It's also mentioned in the X-Men, in the comic The X-Men. It's mentioned in the novel It. And perhaps most intriguingly, it's mentioned in forums on the internet where people argue that they have either come into contact with a tulpa or created their own, and they are serious. They are not trolling. They are not joking. In 2009, the subject appeared on the discussion boards of 4chan. A couple of anonymous members started to experiment with creating tulpas.
That's right. And then in 2012, things took a turn when adult fans of My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, I count myself among them. Not in the same way. My kid really likes the show.
So. You're talking about bronies, right?
Bronies. Yeah, I'm not a legit brony, though. But these bronies created a new forum on Reddit and crafted tulpas based on their favorite characters from the show. Ben, I need some more information here. How do you craft a tulpa on Reddit?
Well, on Reddit, this would just be where they talk about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But from what we understand, at least in the Buddhist tradition, there are meditative techniques that are actually complex and demand quite a bit of time. So we can't assume that those same spiritual techniques are being applied to this amalgamation of pop culture, right, and the idea of a created thing.
Mm.
But we do know that these tulpas are typically described in great detail, and there appear to be relatively few commonalities, right? So for someone who believes in non-physical sentient entities, it's not like in The Exorcist where the eponymous exorcist actually says, don't believe anything. It's not a different demon. It's not all these voices. There's only one thing pretending to be many, many other things. To people who believe this, these are individuated, discrete entities. And at this point, there's no proof that such an entity could exist, something built entirely of energy or thought. And yes, we know all matter is essentially just energy, But then the question is, are these adults maybe only hearing themselves and translating it differently, like in the bicameral mind?
Sure. I like that idea.
What about reports of DMT machine elves? And that's the idea that when people ingest certain hallucinogens, they end up encountering these entities. I've heard them called machine elves in, like, you know, drug literature.
Circles.
Yeah, circles.
People on Arrowhead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nailed it. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
No, I don't know about that, but what are these? Are they like manifestations of thought that are given form?
Mm-hmm. Or are they, right, are they your own thoughts looking back at you? Or are you somehow in tune with an entity or entities that you can not usually see? And this opens the door to a wealth of speculation, also several layers of skepticism, I'm sure, for many people listening. But for people who believe that these non-corporeal entities can exist, what they typically present as proof is the idea that these hallucinations all share certain common traits, regardless of who takes a certain drug when. So for people who believe it's DMT, they might say that every DMT trip has the potential to obey the same plot points almost, which is fascinating. But you have to wonder, is there a confirmation bias there? And it leads us to another bigger question. Is it possible for a meme, an emotion, or an idea to become sentient?
Hmm.
I think that's spooky because I have a lot of weird ideas. I don't know if I want them coming back.
Yeah, I mean, isn't that just, you know, singularity, a different form of singularity kind of? I don't know.
That's interesting, yeah. And this is a question that we want to hear your opinion about. To conclude today's episode, we do have to say whenever we address issues of mental health or mental wellness, want you to know that if you have concerns or worries, there are people waiting to help you or address those concerns, answer questions. You're not alone. You can call the SAMHSA Treatment Referral Helpline at 1-877-726-4727. You can also visit mentalhealth.gov for immediate assistance.
And if you want more information on what we talked about at the top of the show in terms of imaginary friends and their effects on children and their development, there is a group of researchers at the University of Oregon collectively working at a place called the Imagination Research Lab, and they pretty exclusively study that very thing. From their website, it says they look into the development of imagination in children and its a relation to social understanding, creativity, inhibitory control, and narrative skills, but specifically children's creation of imaginary companions and the role they play in social and cognitive development. You can find links to their work at their site, imaginarycompanions.uoregon.edu/lab.
It's fantastic, and it's important work because, again, current research is relatively sparse. It's difficult to understand the answers that young children would give in interviews. However, right now, psychologists who don't believe that these are separate entities of any sort do believe that there's a cover-up or a conspiracy of sorts, and it's an inner conspiracy or an internal cover-up. They believe that imaginary friends seem to function at times as an emotional stand-in, a sort of mannequin personality upon which a child could place an otherwise uncomfortable or difficult emotion. And this is a little bit cheeky. Several psychologists also argue that children might foist agency for bad behavior upon this other entity. I didn't decide to eat all the cookies. Dr. Pant Smack Bubble Mint told me to do it. And then, well, you know, honey, Dr. Pant Smack Bubble Mint is not real the way that you are. No, you don't understand, Mom. She made me do it. So, you know, it's not my fault that this bad thing happened.
I still do that to this day.
So. right. So oddly enough, if there is a conspiracy, it may be simply children, juveniles using the concept of an imaginary entity to cover up or remove themselves from their own fears, emotions, or consequences of action. And again, The fortunate bottom line here is that for the vast majority of cases, it doesn't seem harmful to children at all. And we have to ask, if we apply this same reasoning to adults, well, if it's not harmful, is there a reason to ask people to stop? I mean, if it's making them happy, it's not hurting them or someone else, should they be allowed their imaginary companions?
Yeah, I mean, if they're not the flavor of imaginary companion that allows them to write off any responsibility for their actions, then I say A-OK. What do you think, listeners? Write us. You can find us on social media at Conspiracy Stuff Show on Instagram. We're just Conspiracy Stuff on Facebook and Twitter. And if you don't want to do any of that, you can write us a good old-fashioned email where we are.
Conspiracy@HowStuffWorks.com.